I'm forever trying to make life simple, trying to understand life, trying to make up rules about life so it's more comprehensible to me and maybe even to others. So the good news is today I have reduced life down to 4 choices. So there you have it. Life consists of 4 fundamental choices. Wow. Thank heavens, I thought life was complicated. I'm glad Tom's going to simplify this for me. So here we go. I'm just going to list these 4 ideas and then delve into them a teeny bit. The first thing is, our choice is to try to get other people to do things for us, to meet our needs, and occasionally to do things with us. So that's the first order of business. Try to get other people to do things for us. Sometimes that doesn't work, and we end up at the second choice, which is we don't try. We don't try as hard as we could. We don't really make the effort. We don't try to do what is possible. We hold back. Later on, this natural impulse to do, to acquire energy, to achieve, to protect our own interests and whatever it is we've acquired and to translate it, express it, and so on, all of that impulse comes out and we go, oh, you know what? You know what? I've got to do this by myself. It's me against the world. I have to do it all by myself, alone. I can't rely on anybody, to include God. That's the third choice. A lot of people get into that at some point in their lives when the God of their expectations or other people have proven to be unpredictable and not fulfill what was expected of them. But the fourth choice is when we arrive at that place where we let divine consciousness do what we want. It delivers life to us. Now, we cooperate by deciding consciously on what we would like or better. But we recognize that the divine is the one that is creating this stuff, and we align with that energy. I think there's so much struggle, so much unhappiness, so much anger and sadness and you name it going on is because people don't understand these 4 choices that they've are looking at in their lives, maybe opting for 1 or 2 or 3, or ideally will arrive later on at number 4. But lack of understanding how this works causes a lot of agita and frustration. I think most of us will arrive at some conclusion that long term only the 4th choice is really workable, because it's the only one that's actually capable of producing the results that we would want in our lives. When we can examine, and I know this is true for me, when I examine the most wonderful things that occurred into my life, there's very little doingness on my part. They just seem to occur in response to a previously thought that, if I wasn't aware of it, I would think, gee, how did this occur? Completely magical. But in fact, I can see the origins of the thoughts and feelings, and then later on when they show up in physical manifestation, I still have been able to see that connection. It's like, oh, wow. But between the thought and the manifestation, oftentimes it seemed like I was completely uninvolved consciously. When we start life as an individual, we try to get other people to meet our needs. It's how it works. Just think, very few of us, as infants, climbed out of the crib and went into the kitchen and, you know, made ourselves breakfast or lunch or dinner. We know that human babies require an enormous amount of care over an extended period of time, far more than the babies of other species. Like, we really require a lot of care. So this idea that we're going to do it alone, on our own, like, it certainly doesn't happen in the early years of our lives. You know, occasionally we'll try to establish our freedom and break bonds, you know, the terrible twos and threes, that kind of, I want to do it, I want to do it, and answering no to every single statement or command of our parents. But at the end of the day, they have to put us to bed. At the end of the day, we take a lot of care. Human babies who are, I'll say, more effective at getting people to do for them, to take care of them, to meet their needs, are babies that usually thrive. Babies who either don't get sufficient care because of the circumstances, right, they're orphans or and put in an orphanage or some other situation relative to them, or what is even more common is some sort of, I'll say, a emotional deficiency or a responsibility deficiency in their caregivers. So they're not getting the care they want because their parents are, like, overwhelmed or non-functioning for one reason or another. Those babies can be stunted physically and emotionally and mentally. You know, the story that was told in, I guess, post-communist Eastern Europe when they come across to orphanages where children were placed, and because they had such little human interaction, their failure to thrive, and that's really the word, failure to thrive, is these people died from lack of human interaction, human care, human bonding. Had enough food, but the real energy they needed was insufficient, and they were stunted to death. You could say, ah, oh, beautiful babies. Oh, look at that beautiful baby. Oh, that beautiful baby. Oh, and the baby that gets, they obviously get a lot more attention than, say, a deformed baby or a misshapen baby or an unattractive baby or a sickly baby. And say, oh, no, parents can take that as a reflection of something being wrong with them, and instead of responding to this as a, this is an opportunity to grow in the ability to be loving to an infant, they're like, I'm not gonna do that. They back away in order to protect themselves from loss, and meanwhile, stranding the baby. Babies born prematurely and end up in neonatal ICU. Right, it's like, oh, they're in an incubator, and this, you know, they're getting a lot of care. No, no, medical care is not really an adequate or equivalent substitute for maternal care and bonding and loving. You know? And you can imagine that a baby who is born prematurely, and when you think of that, they are acquiring energy, acquiring energy, acquiring energy, and the acquiring energy, that developmental stage in pregnancy, stops because the baby is now born. It's like, wait, I'm not finished. And oftentimes there are heart problems because the heart has not fully formed. Other organs are not fully formed. All kinds of complications can occur. And the physical development, you know, just the size of the body, you know, the other day Marianne was saying, oh, this baby is now, in our hometown, a grandchild of a friend, is now 3 pounds. Like, whoa. In the old days, that baby would not have survived. Now, that baby is going to survive, but at what cost? What cost to the family? What cost to the baby? What cost to society? But to the baby. If the baby is fully functional, mentally and emotionally, later on, that's great. I question that likelihood, though, because of that insufficient energy, to me, imprints a particular point of view on these babies. And so they'll constantly want people to do for them, way past childhood. And they'll be trying to acquire this kind of energy. Recently, I read an article about measuring the intelligence of a dog. It was an interesting article, and I have a toy poodle. She's a little smarty pants. Toy poodles are recognized as being intelligent dogs, maybe the second smartest dog after, I guess, an Australian sheepdog, or I think is known to be the smartest. They can do amazing things. But poodles are intelligent. So I wanted to read the article. So it was describing what was going on, and it was cool. But in the final analysis, this is the metric that this guy was using. How well a dog could get people to take care of it, to feed it, and to protect it. That was intelligence and success right there. If a dog could do that, that was success for a dog. And for a dog to be able to do that, obviously it has to be very purposeful in doing that. I thought it was really, really cool how that was defined. And I think about Nikki Nouveau, our baby. She is very successful at getting us to care for her, and we wouldn't have it any other way. But it occurred to me that the dogs observed in that study, you know, when this guy is trying to measure this, success and intelligence, it's like, they were all wanted. Those dogs were wanted. The people made conscious decisions to have those dogs, much like we did with Nikki. We wanted to have her. We thought about it and wanted to have her. But in the case, unlike that scenario, how about the case of unwanted babies or unwanted dogs? And there were plenty of them around, as you know. As we were driving yesterday on I-75, I saw a big sign saying, you know, encouraging people to neuter or spay their cats and dogs rather than let them run loose and have more offspring. And the emphasis of the sign was, don't litter. If you're going to take care of them and they're wanted, that's a good thing. If they're not, you're not going to take care of them and they're not wanted, then those litters are not really necessary. But if you just think of unwanted babies and dogs and cats and that reduced flow of caring energy, of respectful energy, of loving energy that these animals are not going to get or these babies are not going to get, seems inevitable that it's going to produce a less intelligent, a less socialized, a less loved and loving being. It's interesting to think of children in a crib when they're first born, right? And I think developmentally, these kids over time become aware of themselves by becoming aware of what they are not. You know, like the mobile hanging over them in a crib that is swinging back and forth. At some point, that child must realize that's different than me. My hand reaching up is different than the thing I'm reaching up to. Oh. And then I think this comparison, and this is a loaded topic, they begin to compare themselves to other people and objects. And maybe in some cases it's okay. But it's when the judgment goes into that. Oh, and they judge one good and one bad. Not so good. If a child is in a crib and their needs are being met effectively, they go like, hey, you know, this is cool. I'm here. They're out there, and they're taking care of me. They're loving me. They're meeting my needs. They're making me feel good. They're making me feel safe and not like I belong, that I'm important and validated. They explain stuff to me. Now, they poke me and prod me and wipe me and clean me and dress me and undress me. But it seems to be done with element of respect. I think that's a different kind of baby. You say in an ideal condition, right? That sense of, say, connectedness, I belong, and security and self-esteem. Well, I don't think it's going to result in that kid going, oh, this is how it has to always be. I got to be in this crib all the time, and everybody has to take care of me, or even when I'm out of this crib, everybody has to take care of me and do for me. Now, that may start out that way, but with a child whose self-esteem is built and they start to get images of doing things, they're going to go, I want to do some things for myself. Because I'm loved, because I'm safe, because I'm connected, I want to start reaching out I have the confidence to do that. That's an ideal condition. But in the non-ideal condition, the failure to get one's needs met, whether it's due to parental overwhelm, which is pretty easy to understand in a family where both parents are working, trying to pay the bills and put food on the table, or if you've got multiple children, or you've got somebody sick in the family, and you've got problems with careers and work situations, all now all of a sudden there are a lot of competing energy patterns seeking attention, and the baby, if it's kind of docile, not having a tantrum, not squawking, I'll be right there, baby, I'll be right there, and other things come first. But that baby, if it's not so docile, is trying to get its needs met, but it's not happening, it's not happening, it's not happening. We could call it neglect. That baby could conclude, you know, the situation, it's hopeless. It's hopeless. I want something, I need something, I'm reaching out for something, I want, I'm squawking, I'm whimpering, I'm doing things, and it's not happening. I am not getting the energy that I want. I'm not getting that connectedness that I want. And if they conclude it is not going to happen now and it's not going to happen in the future, babies can succumb. Just shut it off. That reaching for what they want becomes less aggressive and they just lay there. Less active, less causative, because, hey, I learned from experience, it is not going to happen. And when that hopelessness or even depression, and it shows up in babies, this is where they describe the baby and the condition as failure to thrive. They label a baby like that. That condition's failure to thrive. But it's like, well, why? Why? Why would a plant not thrive? Lack of energy, lack of sun, lack of water, lack of nutrition in the soil. That's why it's failing to thrive. Oh, a farmer wouldn't allow that. But with babies, we allow that. I just described that second of four choices. Trying not to do things in your own self-interest because, frankly, experience has convinced us it's futile. It's not going to work. It's just wasted effort. Why should I try? It's not going to produce the results I want. And I failed before, I failed before, I failed before, you know, one or more times. And it's like, then I get disappointed. You know, my expectations are unfulfilled. It's too emotionally painful. I'm not doing it. Okay. Think of elephants. Being trained as little elephants where they tie a rope around their leg, hoping that elephant will recognize that it cannot pull free, cannot break the rope. Later on in life, they don't even try. They don't even try because they remember the lesson. Oh, no, I tried that once. A lot of times, actually, when I was little, didn't work. And so here I am. Nothing has changed. Other than now I'm gigantic and everything changed, but they hold on to that earlier teaching and don't try to break the rope. Children typically don't immediately succumb unless they are born to a severely depressed mother. Babies now are recognized, oh, that baby's depressed, I wonder why. Take a look at mama. Oh, wow. This is relatively new. You go, we're not as evolved as we like to think we are. Because these babies naturally, except under that condition, or fetal alcohol syndrome, then normally and naturally, their survival instincts will kick in. They will trigger and go, no. I'm going to fight to get what I want. I'm going to fight to get my needs met. So that baby starts whimpering. It's like, oh, that's not doing the job. Okay, I need to crank this up a bit. I'll intensify this cry. And then the crying increases. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I've seen this in action. Kids will stand up in the crib and start shaking the railings, or, you know, howling and throwing toys and, you know, having a full-blown temper tantrum, trying to get their needs met. You know, they will really crank it up a bit. One of the problems that happens, and maybe this is more of a boy thing, that a child can decide that doing things by themselves with no one's support, but being personally powered by anger, you know, that raging in the crib, trying to get its needs, but throwing stuff, getting them. Now, we identify, if we've ever seen a man do that in our environments, oh, yeah, comparing myself to him, yep, I'm one of them, and it's legitimized. And if we think that's a workable strategy, we might adopt it as being such. And that approach is an example of the third choice. I got to do it on my own. I got to do it on my own. And well, it's hard to do it on my own right now because I'm not angry enough. So let me get angry. And that is not an uncommon process. I need to overcome inertia. I have to break free of this hold of gravity in order to get myself to do stuff. And how do you do that? I need to hate the current situation and use that anger to power my activity. Ooh, that's tough on the vehicle. That's tough on the vehicle. But I think many of us do it, have learned how to do that. That person becomes a hardened individual. That hardened shell is, I'm doing it on my own. I'm going to protect myself. I don't need you. I'm going to do this on my own. And you can see this, people unwilling to ask for help. And frankly, even if they don't ask for it and somebody offers that help to them, say, let me help you, no, they're not able to accept help because it's, talk about being loaded, it's like, no, this is like the Trojan horse. If you help me, then I have to open up and then I become vulnerable. No, thank you. And that approach, that just isolates that armored personality even more. That third approach is difficult. It's difficult. Well, you can see this in people. There can be a closed-mindedness that surrounds that person. So, I got an idea. I'd like to offer this to you. It could make your life easier. Boom, boom. Bounces off that closed mind. No way. They don't let it in. They don't let it in. This is another, you know, I'm not going to be open to it for a couple of different reasons. First of all, I already know it's not going to meet my needs. I have to do this on my own. So if you offer any help, it's not going to be of any value to me. And possibly, and maybe even probably, now it just complicates the heck out of things if I have to take input from you. I already decided all by myself, what needed to be done. And now you want to complicate my life by, my opinion is, and you should do, and it's like, no. I'm not going to open to that stuff, and it's too complicated. Leave it. There are ways that people who have adopted the second choice, right, there's no sense in trying to do things. They have low striving, even depression. These people can even periodically, though, erupt in anger. You know, holding back this energy to create, to contribute, is no small thing. That really requires a lot of energy to hold that back, to dam that energy up. Like, no, I'm not going to feel it, not going to feel it, boom. And then they explode, yeah. And that anger, I think, is oftentimes, it can go out at other people, but it's primarily directed at self. It is their anger at themselves is the problem. I think you can see this example, when it's directed at the people, showing up in the news as people walking around with guns, shooting other people, innocent people. The other thing, which is more constructive, is the third choice, right? I have to do it on my own, all by myself, get out of the way. That anger can be directed at other people. But I would think it's because the other people are perceived as impediments. You're in my way. Get out of the way. It's not crazy anger. It's like, you're in my way. I just push you out of the way. Because you're blocking me. You're standing in the way. Since I have to do it on my own, your presence is either as a witness off to the side or an impediment by being in front of me. So move out of the way. That's not as damaging, of course, as what I described a couple of minutes before. The destructive person who's been bottling it up, bottling up, bottling up, bottling up, and then has this explosionary reaction to the pressure and become, you know, an eruption like a volcano and really causes destructive experiences for a lot of people. One of the many great things in Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth is in letter one, Christ is describing his awareness of the divine. Oh, he labels it the truth of existence. This is how life works, people. This is how life works. And awakening to the true nature of God, right, as he's discovered, he never really accepted the stuff he was taught by the rabbis in the temples. You know, so this guy likes some people. He doesn't like other people. He's going to whack some people, and he's going to bring plagues on others, and he's going to bless some people, and he's going to kill some people, and smite others. It's like, what? This doesn't make any sense. And he was so relieved to discover, not only did it not make sense, it didn't exist. It was a myth. So he's going, oh, man, this is so great. This loving power always, always is providing for all of its creation all the time. Oh, so relieved, so reassured that he was right in the first place to question the existence of that male god punitive obedience demanding character that the Jews were talking about. It's like, oh man, this is so good. He was overflowing with joy at discovering that. Not what I'd been taught, but rather all loving to all things, all times. And the when he was specific in letter one, we're talking about the nine items that he realized, oh, wow, this loving power all the time providing for growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, rhythm, all within a spiritual system of law and order, the law of cause and effect. Wow, this is what divine intention is. That's the job of divine intention, to provide those things for its creations. Whoa, how cool is that? And what do we have to do? What do we have to do as the created? We need to be open, receptive, and allow the support to carry us to growth, nutrition, and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment, and need, work, survival, rhythm, all within a system of spiritual law and order. It's going in that direction. That divine energy flow is going in that direction. It's like, all we have to do is be receptive of it, understand it, try to align with it vibrationally. It's like, wow. So how do you do that? It's like, well, reach out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and ask for enlightenment. Help me to do that. I want to be aware of how to get in alignment with divine intention so divine intention can express to me and through me. Hey, that's pretty easy. That seems like a good fourth choice. That's what I want to choose out of my four choices. Yeah, me too. So what are some of the reasons choice number four is so difficult? people, I don't understand it. I don't know. I don't believe it. No, it's, you know, this is nonsense. Why is it so difficult to embrace? Well, I think it starts with, we're not taught about it. We're not taught that that's what divine consciousness is all about. Right? If somebody were to say, this is what divine consciousness is doing, your job is to get in alignment with it, not you trying to, you know, get God to do what you want. Your job is to do what divine intention is automatically doing for you and all other creatures, all other beings, all other creations. Oh, yeah, yeah. So not getting that kind of training growing up. Why? Because there are different priorities, right? Obedience, obedience. That's the main lesson taught to us about God. God wants you to be obedient. To what? To what? Oh, you need to obey all these rules. Those are God's rules? Yes, they're God's rules. You sure? Yep. Who told you? I know somebody. And it's obedience. That's the main lesson. That's the main lesson. Not reaching out to this, to God for loving support any and all times. That's not what we're taught. Our parents preferred obedience rather than, Mommy, can, Daddy, can I, Mommy, can I have this? Can I have this? Daddy, can I have this? Can I have this? They should have said, hold on. Let me teach you how to ask divine consciousness as compared to you asking me. Oh, that might have alleviated some pressure for them. But we weren't taught. And another reason is we tend to ascribe parental responses, you know, our biological mothers and our biological fathers, like, I think God is just like them, but maybe bigger and more invisible and up on a higher cloud than these people. And if God is anything like these two people, scary, unpredictable, volatile, loving, crazy, this, that, who? It's like, that's risky. That's risky. That's like playing in a minefield. Are you kidding me? I'm not gonna ask them for help all this time. Like, ooh, that's scary. Sometimes when I thought I was gonna get love, I got yelled at. Other times I thought I'd get yelled at, and I got patience and compassion. It's like, I don't understand what drives these people. Ego. They're ego-driven. That's not the characteristic you'll find in divine consciousness. That's ego of a human being. The other reasons, our egos tell us we are the ultimate means to fulfill our needs and our wants, and we need to listen to this ego. This is the way we maintain and protect our individuality. It's us. It's us against the world, and don't forget that. And the ego criticizes us emotionally and physically, even attacks us, right? You're like, yeah, what's all this self-talk? You. It's like, Then you look around and hear about people who cut themselves or otherwise display, I'll say, harmful actions to themselves. Like, what's up with that? What's up with that? Why are they physically attacking themselves? I think that's because the ego is in complete control of some of these folks. It's the ego as an advisor. Oh, I'm doing this for you. I'm telling you, you're not enough. You're not enough. And, you know, I'm driving you harder so you can be enough, which is mighty elusive unless you can just, I'm already enough. Thank you. I'm there. But the ego will say, we're not enough. We can't get what we want. We're too lazy. We're too this. We're too that. Not enough of this and not enough of that. We don't deserve it. And on and on and on and on. All kinds of excuses for what we're experiencing. We're listening to a terrible advisor in many cases. And we as human beings, and also driven by ego, and driven by other people's egos, we're unbelievably willing to promote substitutes and buy substitutes, accept substitutes, use substitutes as the best choice to get what we want. not choice number four, but I need a substance. I need an activity, or I need a substance. I need more cars, more money, more sex, drugs, rock and roll, need more work, need more material goods to be enough. Well, I suppose on the one hand, excessive consumerism produces some jobs, produces a lot of other things too, ill health and despair and on and on and on and on and on, addictions. I think those are the results of those kind of efforts. You know, let's accept substitutes. Going in the wrong direction. Well, that heroin wasn't enough. I must need more heroin. Nope. You're in the wrong direction, and you're going further in the wrong direction. Substances and those kind of activities are not the answer. You think with all these noisy distractions created in our minds, by our minds, by our egos, by the outside marketers, it's no wonder that meditation is so highly beneficial to us, right? Like, time out. I'm going to have a break. I'm going to have a break and quiet the mind down so the noise in it is down to a manageable level and I can be quiet enough to receive awareness. Otherwise, that static, that noise, like your head is sounds like Yankee Stadium during a game, we could never receive awareness. It can't get through the crowd, if you will. And when that static and that noise is so great, it can pull us downward into a hole. If we can code, if we can pray, if we can meditate, we might be able to withstand this tendency that, oh, it feels like sometimes getting caught in an undertow, right? People that have been near oceans might understand this as a image. We're on a beach, then we go into the water, and then all of a sudden we get pulled into an undertow. That current pulls us down and out, away from the beach. And the ego would scream to us, fight it, struggle against it, fight it, swim harder, harder, try harder. But if the current is too strong for us, we would just become tired. And then at that point, then the ego would be coaxing us in a different direction. Give up. You can't do it. You failed, you're tired, you're weak. And the real life situation, in a situation where we get pulled into an undertow in an ocean, and maybe in an emotional undertow in a work or family situation or financial situation, is to stop resisting the current. We are divinely supported with a natural buoyancy. And so this is how you do it. If you're caught in the ocean and you're getting an undertow, you hold your breath and you don't resist. And that current will pull you out. It will pull you out. And all it takes is a little bit of awareness and a little bit of strength of discipline to realize that, you know what? That current is strongest near the shore. But as it moves away from the shore, goes outward into the ocean, it becomes weaker and it releases its grip. So when it releases its grip, we're free to swim. And the way to swim is not into shore, but horizontally. And then after a little while, 50 yards or 100 yards, and then swim into shore. The current will release its hold on us as it moves out. That's it. People who drown in the ocean like that are people who fight to the point beyond exhaustion and then can't stay afloat. You say, oh, they drowned. It was actually the act of resisting a more powerful rhythm, right? Currents are rhythms, ebbs and flows, high tide, low tide, right? Night and day, seasonality. These ebbs and flows, these rhythms, if you try to swim against the current, it is a lot harder than going with the current. Sometimes being aware to not resist a naturally occurring rhythm can save your life. I've had clients tell me that story as well as this being valid advice. But resisting a more powerful rhythm, in this case, could result in death. But people are, I have clients that say, I'm frustrated. What is that? They're resisting a natural rhythm of time. I want something to occur faster than it naturally will occur. So I'm frustrated. Why not allow it to take as long as it takes? Why not align with the natural rhythm of time in that situation and accept it and relax and let it be? But we think we need to control it. That's not a good choice. A fourth choice is about acceptance rather than resistance. If we can accept what is, and when the time is right, allow the creation of the condition that we want. And we can do that. We can allow the creation of the condition we want because we can know we are divinely supported. We're divinely supported. And I think it is that awareness that we're being divinely supported every second of every minute of every hour of every day that allows us to relax. Oh, I'm in this ocean of God. There are natural rhythms. I understand that. And my job, while I'm in the ocean of God, is to look around for blessings and rhythms and to use them to carry us to where we want to go. That's it. I want to use them to carry me where I want to go. But it's when we, I'll say, burrow deeply into self-consciousness. And we pull back in. You should be able to feel this. You can feel this when you walk into a situation. All of a sudden, you perceive on some level a threat. You can feel yourself shrinking. I've described it in various ways as going into the little circle. But people go, I can feel the shrinking. I can feel it in my stomach. That's it. When we're doing that, we're closing ourselves off to that natural divine flow. It's like, wait, I just felt that. And that it's at that point, when we recognize it, we could go, let me just exteriorize. Let me, instead of focusing inward, like, I got to protect myself. Let me put my attention outward. Let me breathe a couple of times deeply. Open myself up to the knowing that we are always, always blessed and supported. The fourth choice is viable. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our help, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.